Welcome to Season 6, Episode 38 of the Be Conscious Podcast. Today, I'm again joined by Dr. Ricky Jane Adams for an encore broadcast. You may recall that Dr. Adams is the author of 3 books, including Spiritually Fierce, and joins us from Melbourne, Australia. In Season 6 of the Be Conscious Podcast, we continue discussing several human constructs. And today, I am so curious to have Dr. Adams tell us about her experience unpacking the very sensitive race construct. Here we go.
Welcome to the Be Conscious Podcast, the show that brings you enlightened perspectives on the frequency of money, life's many challenges, and those heavy feelings that may be holding you back from living your best life. And now your host, Dr. Susan Nicholas.
Dr. Ricky Jane Adams is the principal of the Institute for Intuitive Intelligence, a world-class global professional intuition and consciousness training school. Ricky Jane is a 3-time author of the best-selling Spiritually Fierce. Her second title, Intuitive Intelligence Training, and the newly released Super Conscious Intuition. Ricky Jane has a doctorate from the University of Melbourne in magical realism, and she has spent over 25 years devoted to her spiritual awakening and as a qualified transpersonal counselor. Ricky Jane, welcome back to the Be Conscious Podcast.
Thank you. I am so grateful to get to spend more time with you.
You know, Ricky Jane, it is an absolute pleasure to hear from you again. And as we're discussing the human constructs that I believe are ripe for transformation and transcendence in this common era of the Earth's existence or humanity's existence on Earth, I'm so interested in something that you mentioned on our prior broadcast about your unpacking of the race construct or the white supremacy race construct, this program that, as you say, we were all infected with when we were born onto the planet.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your first awareness of this unconscious program and how you, I would say, began to get to the root of your experience with this construct in this program?
Yes, that's a great question. And look, there's 2 women in particular that I really owe that awakening to, and that is Leila Saad, who is the educator who created a challenge called Me and White Supremacy, to really allow me to open to the awareness of what was contained in my subconscious, and an Australian woman called Julie Parker, who has a wonderful life coaching institute called Beautiful You. And she was the one who started doing the work with Leila and brought it to my attention. So this was back in, I think, 2019. And it was all happening on Instagram. So Leila Saad at the time had written a blog post that had gone viral, which is was something along the lines of, spiritual white women are the problem. Like, I can't remember the exact title, but it was basically putting the responsibility squarely at the feet of spiritual white women for the cultural appropriation, the de-identification of the leaders of things like yoga, the origins of so much of the Eastern philosophy that were being appropriated without identification, and really putting that responsibility on the shoulders of spiritual white women. It's a brilliant article, and she articulated a lot of her pain as a black woman experiencing her spiritual awakening through the lens of a white woman's process, and then realizing that she was actually, there was no place inside of that for her, that to take these white women as her teachers was actually a form of harm to herself at many, many levels. And she now has a podcast called the Good Ancestors Podcast, and she really changed the way that she was understanding her own spirituality at that time. But what she offered so generously and publicly was this challenge where each day you would show up to mine your subconscious and your conscious. You know, it's not just a matter of what is our subconscious bias. Very often these biases are sitting right there in our consciousness, but because the world affirms them and the world makes it easy for us to be racist towards Black, Brown and Indigenous people, we can just sit with that as the norm, right? We don't have to really question it too deeply, because for white people, it's working. And so, so it was a very humbling experience, and it was a journey akin to, I guess, like a death. My first response was anger. Like, how dare you? I'm not that kind of spiritual white woman. You know, I grew up in the Middle East. Like, all of the objections and the fragility and all of these things where you're like, I'm a good person. I couldn't possibly be a racist. You know, these stories that rise up from the ego to defend me in this particular case. But from that anger of how dare you suggest that my spirituality or my very existence is causing harm, there was that space for curiosity. And I can go further into that, but I just want to see if you want to jump in there before I keep going.
So I think the first thing that came to me about the entire maybe conversation was, why was the focus? I'm not suggesting that everyone doesn't play a role, but why was the focus on white women as opposed to white men?
That is a great question, and I don't have the answer from Layla's perspective right at the top of mind, and it may be in that article, but I believe it is because that her teachers at the time were all white women. So, you know, I've looked a lot further into, you know, a lot of the different, you know, race theory and the unpacking of privilege around this. And there is a definite suggestion that white women are particularly complicit in the harm that is caused to Black, Brown and Indigenous bodies out of their own survival, right? So this alignment with the power center, which happens to be white men. often women cause more harm to women because of that complicit, like that desire to be aligned with the structures of power or the center of power. But from Layla's perspective specifically, I can't give you the answer, although I'm sure it is out there in the world. But for me, the understanding was certainly that so much of the work that is out there in the world in spirituality is being offered by white women. And it is, and I agree with you, you know, I think there's a lot of white men. I mean, I've watched some amazing teachers out there who do incredible things. But if you go back to the origin of their work, it's Eastern philosophy, it's yogic teachings. They've just de-identified it, you know. So I think that it's across all, you know, that white culture, there's this sense of entitlement to take whatever you want. And it isn't specific to women. But I think Layla's experience was specifically the toxicity of so much of that, you know, spiritual culture that she was learning from was led by white women.
Okay. And okay, I can understand it from that explanation. Thank you. Was there ever the acknowledgement that we are all infected with it? Like, we all have this unconscious program, no matter what gender, color, culture, language you speak. It's a part of like the earth experience that we, you know, all have these unconscious biases within us.
Yes. And she speaks a lot about the fact that for Black, Brown and Indigenous people, it is even harder, but the wound is within. They are, you know, just as indoctrinated or with that sense of being lesser than, and that, you know, that racism against the self, but also against each other, right? So yes, hierarchies of, you know, all of the different races having some sense of separation mentality against all of the others, right? So you are in, I know if you're in Hong Kong or you're in the Middle East, both places that I've lived, you know, the in the Middle Eastern culture, you know, very much the expats are considered to be second class citizens. And this is just, you know, part of the culture. And it is absolutely something she talks about, of the need for every single human being on the planet to acknowledge this wound. And I'm using my own language here, but I call it, you know, the wound of separation. Anywhere where we have divided ourselves against ourselves, knowing that according to the cosmic law, all is one, then we are breaking the law and we are creating the nightmare that humanity is currently living. And my experience of it is very much that when these collective unconscious wounds rise to the surface, and this was before Black Lives Matter that I was doing this work, and of course racism is not new, but when there's a groundswell, it is so vital for us to acknowledge, especially as spiritual people, that is our personal responsibility to take action around that collective wound on behalf of all. Now, the other reason that I think Layla was, you know, very much speaking to white women is the idea of privilege. So the privilege of I am free enough, wealthy enough, unlikely to be persecuted, unlikely to be treated badly just because of the color of my skin. Therefore, I have a bigger responsibility to use that freedom for good, to correct the error, right? I don't have the burdens that others are carrying. So if I don't use that to, you know, create that correction of perception that somebody is lesser than me just because of where they were born or what color they are, then I am squandering that privilege. So I have a greater weight. I carry a greater weight of responsibility because I am not burdened by the program that says, you know, black is lesser than or brown is lesser than. And it, you know, it's a really powerful thing to sit with that truth, that people get so confused about privilege, don't they? That they think it means that you've got easy life or lots of money, or no, privilege means that your very existence doesn't cause offense to others. Like white is innocent, you know, black is evil. These are the core archetypal programs in that unconscious wound. And the privilege is I don't have to defend my very existence. I don't have to prove to you that I'm good. You know, you were the assumption in all of our collective unconscious, because of thousands of years of toxic programming, is a wound that we must all take personal responsibility for, but especially those who are not burdened by that wound.
Okay. I, as you were speaking, I couldn't help but to think about when I've seen throughout history, white subjugating white or oppressing white. Like I think of like the Irish,
yes,
or if you consider the Jews white, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But where you've seen a lot of like this infighting.
Yes.
I think about the Indian caste system.
Yeah.
On this, in the same vein, Asians, Japanese hating Chinese, or, you know, I'm not suggesting that this insensitivity is okay, but if I have experienced, if you mistaken an Asian group for another, they become very offended.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not Vietnamese, I'm not this, like, even within the Asian, like the different major cultures, the world, you feel that. Or I think about the Latin culture, the native Latins versus the more, I don't know, modern European, how they call themselves, the Indians versus the people that carry the traits, the heavier traits of the Incas or the Maya, like the ancients, how they are discriminated against. And so even it doesn't seem like it matters. You know, it's not really necessarily about skin color, but I believe it's truly what you called it, this wound of separation.
Yes.
Where for many of us, we believe that to feel better about ourselves or whole, or I don't know exactly what the word is, then someone else has to be beneath us for me to be elevated. The only differences are about perception. The only way to make me feel good about myself, perhaps, is to recognize that I'm somehow better than someone else. That gives me, I don't know, maybe a little bit of self-esteem or bravado, or makes just an illusion that I am not you, even though, as you and I know, we are. We are collectively one.
Yes, it is. It is. You're right. That toxicity is, you know, it's people doing it to their own people. You know, if you're a Muslim living in India or in China, you're in a terrible situation right now where, you know, and this is Indians on Indians, Chinese on Chinese, you know, this doesn't even have to be a different race. That wound of creating division is the nightmare of the ego. And the ego is the part of us that's forgotten as God, right? In my language. And so we are playing out that forgetting. We're playing out that forgetting. And as you say, it all comes down to power. The ego seeks to attain power. And when I can perceive of myself as being of a higher order than someone else, which is the same reason we hoard money rather than ensure that all humanity has its needs met. You know, we want to have power over something else in order to protect our ego and to feel a sense of control and authority in this illusion or dream of life. And the process of awakening consciousness is to awaken to the truth of oneness. So how could I let any child go hungry or be harmed or enslaved if I am truly awake to the truth of oneness, right? How could I possibly want to have money in the bank or a house for my child or, you know, security for myself if any one of my brothers and sisters in God is left hurting, hungry, you know?
Yes.
And we do that. We're like, well, I will love you because I gave birth to you, or I chose you and I put a ring on it, or you gave birth to me, and everyone else is on their own, right? And for some of us, we might extend our circle of safety a little wider. We might do charity work. We might make a donation of some of our income. We might be part of a religious community. We might include that within our circle of safety, right? So if someone in my community needs me, of course I'll make sure they I can support them, but there's still a limit. I'm going to have a limit around how many people I include in my circle of safety, which is a term from Simon Sinek, around this idea of everything is finite. And I think this is what informs this separation mentality. There's not enough. Everything is finite and limited. Therefore, I'm going to protect my own. And I am entitled to do that because of my religious or cultural or racial differences or familiarities, right? If I can see familiarity, then you're part of my community and I will protect you. And our goal as spiritual beings is ultimately to have that circle of safety to encompass all humanity, right? So that there would be no one that we would leave out, that we would never consider that anyone was lesser than. And the reason this is so hard, Susan, is because it is largely subconscious. So we would never walk around thinking, I intentionally exclude people from my compassion and my kindness and, you know, my goodwill and my generosity, but we all do. We all draw lines in the sand. Now, some of those lines are more obvious, like I exclude pedophiles from my circle of safety because that seems really logical. But others are more subtle, like the subtle ways that, for example, if you're talking to someone whose language, their first language is not English, the effort that it might take to understand them, the time and energy that you have to invest to be fully present to them, you may form unintentionally a subconscious bias away from that person because it's easier just to talk to someone who understands my language. And, you know, so we are constantly affirming this separation subconsciously. So when someone says, like, to me, you know, you're a white supremacist, I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm a really good person. How dare you say that? Like, my first reaction is defensive because it's really hard for the conscious part of me to believe that I could possibly carry those programs. And yet we all carry them. In the same way that we all carry the same programs. If we see it in the world, it's within us. You know, we are all carrying the codes of violence that we see in the world because there's only one consciousness. And you and I have made a decision and a commitment to affirm the greater part of ourselves and to keep meeting those biases that prevent us from being in oneness. But most of the world doesn't even know it's operating that way. Most of the world doesn't even know that there is the possibility of that infinite embrace. And so, of course, we're going to stay stuck in these territorial, nationalistic, or tribal loyalties that feel like life or death, right? Look at it with people choosing a football team or a basketball team, you know? We're so tribal.
You said something about, a little bit earlier, about less than. And this is a conversation I actually had with an earlier guest today. Because being in the United States, I'm considered of mixed race in the United States, and the African American and us that are all considered African American, no matter what other mixes or, you know, what other cultures we embody, we're about 12% of the U.S. population. Yeah. So we're considered a minority group. And so being born into a minority group and into a minority family, I have felt the ire. I have felt discrimination, as has everyone in my family and throughout the probably existence of us.
Yeah.
And so it's obviously something that we carry within our, perhaps a wound that has not healed in our energetic essence and our beingness. And I think what happens is you can start to believe it, right? You can start to believe that it's true, that you're somehow less than.
Yeah.
Or because you're even called that, like you're labeled a minority, which is in its definition is less. And then you're provided with less resources, less opportunities, less kind of community connections. You have health disparities. Everything is less. We're often in depraved or impoverished communities, which looks less than what other people have. And so you can embody those circumstances as yourself, right? I think this is part of the whole generational poverty wound, that we can look at a circumstance outside of ourselves and embody that circumstance as our own. So if everything around me is less than, if all the labels, if all the rhetoric tells me I'm less than, then so it is, and that I am less than. And so what I would do in my youth, in my younger years, is I would look for evidence of me being less smart, less capable, less intelligent, less trustworthy, less beautiful, less strong, less everything, talented. And I couldn't find the evidence of it. I tried and I looked because I had been indoctrinated that life would be more of a struggle for me because I'm less than. And then on top of just being born in a minority group, it's like I'm also born in the feminine. And so it's like, oh, so you've got double the curse, you know? Not only are you Black, but you're a Black woman. Oh my gosh, there is no one lower on the rung. And so I would literally search for the evidence of the truth of it, and I couldn't find it. I knew that I wasn't less intelligent less smart, less capable, less trustworthy, less talented, less of a person, less of a being. And so I outright rejected the race construct. I was like, this is absurd. But what I recognized is that other people weren't so easy to let it go. That they were like, no, I'm broke, I'm poor, I'm black, I'm this, I'm that. And all the, you know, the derivations of it. And I just said, I don't think think it exists. I think this mindset, this program exists, but I don't believe it's true. I believe it exists, but I personally do not believe that it's true. And I feel just as worthy, just as intelligent, just as beautiful, just as strong, just as capable as anybody else. But I know that other people outside of me would perceive my situation as being challenged just because of the embodiment that I carry. And so I find, you know, quite because of this introspective questioning and this evidence seeking that I've done throughout my life, I don't often participate in conversations about race because I believe it is absurd and that it is elementary and that it is untrue. Not that people haven't done vicious, violent, disgusting acts in the name of this falsehood. I'm not saying that those things have not happened. I just don't believe the program is true. I believe that we are all divine in nature, that we are all embodiments of the same source energy of all creation, that we are all connected. Earth School, this cosmic kindergarten, as I like to call it, is a formidable place to mature the eternal soul. And we've all earned our place here to do our soul work. All of us. And so I think about it as like, okay, we are all human beings. And thus we all possess the human like genetic code. Like it's of the human beings. Like we are a species, the Homo sapiens sapien. And we all share the same code. What differs is that we express, we have different expression of genes. And so it's what is expressed that creates this beautiful diversity of life. But you have, you know, genes for eye color. So do I. You have genes for hair and the heart and the lungs and breathing. So do I. We just express differently. And I believe the expression varies just like it does in any other species. It's because where our ancestors had to live and survive on this formidable planet. We needed different traits to survive, period. And so that's to me all that this is. It's like we are all the same. Like, I mean, as a surgeon, I remember having these epiphanies because I'm just going to say the surgeon as the observer. So the person that is opening the body and looking inside of it, to have that perspective, you recognize very quickly that we are all the same. We are all the same. And I said, what's interesting is, In that context, the reason I use surgery as a context is not just because I've had that experience personally, but the person is completely in that sterile condition. They're all like covered. So there's all this blue draping, the sterile drapes. So all that you see is the inside. And when it comes, you have no, if you walk into a surgical suite and you're looking inside, you would not be able to tell anything except this is a human being. And I think that is it. Yeah. There's this, you know, this organ that we have that we call the skin.
Yes.
And that skin, it's our largest organ. Everybody has it. We all need it to survive. But that is what is, that is like, to me, the veil of separation right there. It's right into that external shell that embodies
the spirit. And so I just, I feel like I completely reject racism. I used to feel angry, just like you. You said, it's like you go through the steps, if you will, of anger, frustration, of like questioning, of curiosity. I've so far released that I don't even feel as sick as I used to feel about it, because that sickness that was in me, I have transmuted. And now I have complete compassion for all those that still hold the wound. And so one of the things that I have noticed is, because racism has been a big part of American history in our little baby country, there's a lot of footage of the civil rights movement and so forth, slavery.
Yeah.
And every time you see these stills, these images of the past, the perpetrator of the racism, usually it's, if they're unhooded, and in our country, people would wear white hoods. So let's say they take their hoods off and you see their faces. The face of racism is so contorted and ugly. It is so vile and nasty. And I think, well, if you are so supreme and then you know it, then why do you have so much hate? To me, that's it. It's when you succumb to this wound of separation, when you fully succumb to it, meaning you fully believe it, your ego relies on it to feel good about itself, then it actually distorts you. It creates this ugliness.
Yeah, but it's here in service to us, and that's the thing. We can't argue with the fact that we live in a racist world, right? And that is the medicine that we need. So whatever the dream of this life offers us is the medicine. And the challenge for someone like you, my darling, is that you have been raised within a context of living in that experience of being, you know, cast as lesser than, whether or not you took up the offer of that wound or not. And for many people, there's not even an awareness that there's a choice, right? So your level of consciousness is what allows you to ask questions and say, based on the data that I've gathered, I can see this is a false premise, you know, that racism is a false premise. But for most people, when we are born into the dream, we're born, you know, we drink from the river of forgetting, and we're born into the nightmare of separation, which is what the level of consciousness in the dream in the majority is at this point. And so racism, as one phase of separation, offers us the antidote within it, because the fear is the messenger. Fear is always the messenger. But in order to engage with
that,
you have to have had the possibility planted in your mind that maybe this is not true. So that distortion of and hatred of looking upon the face of a racist, it is so righteous. You know, religious zealous so often informs this righteousness of, this is truth, right? Like, I am right, therefore I am defending what is right by hating you. And that black and white thinking, that extremist thinking, is what is the ultimate ego defense. So you're sort of calling upon or speaking from a place that 95% of the world has never visited, which is the place of, is this true?
There are so many examples, Ricky Jane, that it's counterintuitive, that how could this be true and right if it's so distorting and ugly and hateful?
Because, you know, we're so in our base chakra as a human collective, this tribal warfare of loyalty as survival, right? Like, so to question whether or not white is better or black, men are better than women, you know, all of these, you know, Christian is better than Jewish or whatever the divisions are, could be to bring one's own survival into question, because the conditions in your community, in your tribe, say it is not safe to ask. And it extends, you know, as we know, way beyond race, but we're here to talk about the construct of race, you know, to be a gay person inside of the Catholic Church, to, you know, all of these experiences of being other. And othering is that ultimate weapon of the ego, right? You are not me. And the ultimate statement of oneness is, I am that. I am that.
Yes.
And so you see how there's, until you are willing, vulnerable and humble enough to have your consciousness cracked open, mm-hmm. which, by the way, doesn't just happen just because you want it to, and it certainly doesn't just happen because you pursue spirituality. And I think that was Leila Saad's point about going after spiritual white women in the way that she did, is that just because you think you're woke doesn't mean that you aren't a racist, right? Like, you might sit down and meditate. You might go and, you know, on retreat to Bali, you might buy all the crystals, but you are still holding a program of white supremacy within you. And until you meet that, you're not doing the real work. And I think that's the point of all of this, mm-hmm. is that meeting these social, cultural, you know, social justice issues in the world is the most profound spiritual work that there is. And so often we use our spirituality mm-hmm. to bypass what is happening in the world because it's too uncomfortable. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to sit with the discomfort of that. So we ghettoize ourselves and hide, you know, especially if you're privileged, you know, in whatever way, you've got lots of money, you can go on retreat in the most magnificent places and never touch the ground, never have to feel the despair or the, you know, so often we go to developing countries to do our spiritual awakening and completely ignore the impoverishment and the you know, child slavery and the things that allow us to have these really great experiences because it's cheaper in that country or whatever else it is. There's so many layers to how we can use our spirituality to mm-hmm. keep us in a blindfold. I don't want to see, smell, touch, taste the ugly things in the world. I'm just going to sit in my bubble of white light with all my crystals and be like fully, you know, in love with life. And actually this festering mm-hmm. wound mm-hmm. of separation is sitting in your subconscious. And I think Layla's call to action was face the world. Mm-hmm. Let mm-hmm. the world be the medicine for our healing. Stop pretending these things are not happening, because pretending they're not happening is what is causing the harm. When good people do nothing, right? We know this. When good people do nothing because we want to have our heads up our ass because it's too uncomfortable. And spirituality mm-hmm, mm-hmm. is a place where a lot of people go to hide. Not you and not me, but a lot of people go to hide from the difficulty. They want something to numb them out and give them a place to retreat, literally, from the difficulties and the discomforts. And what if we look at these mm-hmm. wounds not as the problem, but as the solution? Mm-hmm. You know, we're in a nightmare of separation, right? How can I see that playing out in my own consciousness, in my own life, in my own body right now? And what can I do to be the antidote to that? And instead of yelling at the world or blaming other people, where can I heal that wound of separation within me? And for me, as with you, that's always an energetic choice first, right? To change my consciousness, but not in a superficial way. I have to go and sit in that festering wound, sitting in the basement. Like, because every woman carries the patriarchy inside of her as well. You know, women are worse to each other than anybody else. And that is internalized patriarchy. So wherever we see the fear rising at a mass level, we can say this is serving the awakening of consciousness. Now, what am I going to do with that? To use Caroline Mace's question, what will you do with your pain? And we must not let our spirituality put barriers around us that keep us away from the deep work of engaging with the dream. It is a dream, but it's a necessary dream.
I think Yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here to do this work. You know, like, yeah, I completely agree with you. I wanted to touch on something about the resources part of the discussion, about the whether it's the white men or women, or the, you know, or the white women who are complicit in the white supremacy. But these are also the very same people that have the resources to change it. Can you share a little bit more about the process? So this isn't something that you can just throw money at. I mean, so when it comes to resources, what does that really mean? As far as healing the wound?
Yeah, I actually think throwing money at it is not a bad idea. And I think there's very intentional ways that we can do that. So this idea of reparations is a really big one. That actually investing in, you know, Black, Brown, Indigenous teachers. So as a white woman, one of the first things I realized as I woke up to this white supremacy is that I had no teachers or influences in my life in a firsthand way who were Black, Brown, or Indigenous. So I might lean on a lot of yogic philosophy, but my immediate teacher is white, right? So the choice to look for and seek out and elevate, you know, melanated voices, I think that was one of the kind of catchphrases that was used, you know, elevate Black, Brown, Indigenous teachers by seeking them out. If you've got money to spend on a coach or on a teacher or on a healer, don't just be whitewashed about it just because your Instagram feed is full of white people because you only follow white people. So one of the things that I did as part of that challenge was, and following the lead of people like Julie Parker, is intentionally making sure that I looked for teachers who didn't look like me and then spent money with them, right? So I invested in an anti-racism consultant to come and audit my business and to show me my blind spots. I invested in, you know, having an anti-racism teacher come in and work with my students. So, you know, really spending money on people who were experts in this space, who could come and give me the information that I didn't have, not just incidentally for free through the internet, but actually paying them. So when I go to Bali, you know, I work with a local priestess and I pay money to her and her team to guide us spiritually, because I don't want to just go to Bali and say, oh, it feels really nice here because everything's so spiritual. There's a reason it feels so good. It's because there are people there who are working on what they call Bali spirit. So my job is not to just go there, run my retreat and go home. My job is to invest in the people who are doing the work on the ground and bring them in as the experts into that retreat experience. So absolutely, you know, my coach is a mixed race woman. I make intentional choices now to choose the right people, but to understand that if I stayed in my blind spots, it would be so easy to assume everybody doing the work is white or looks like me, right? Because that is also part of the subconscious bias, is that we unintentionally seek out those people who look like or show us, you know, ourselves, right? So I actually do think that, yes, throwing money at it is a very good plan. And then, you know, then you can also make, you know, there's a lot of Patreons you can join and you can invest in great teachers who are doing this work online for free and you can buy their books and you can, you know, go forward. Then one of the big things that came out of my understanding was, is not asking for free education from Black, Brown, Indigenous teachers, but actually to educate myself, to pay them for the good information and education, but then to take that forward into my community. So my job, I feel very much, is to be a bridge between the white women that I work with and that awakening consciousness by helping them navigate that, because it should not be the responsibility of Black, Brown, and Indigenous people to carry the burden of educating us, you know, especially when that isn't being properly remunerated.
Can I ask you a question about your trajectory. You said you started out angry, like in denial. What were the steps in the, I guess, the program? I don't know if that's what you would call it, you know, this white supremacist. I don't know if you call it a program. What were the steps and how did your spirit evolve? Like, are you still angry?
No. I mean, the anger was defensiveness. It was like, I'm a good person. Like, how very dare you? You know, I'm a good spiritual person. You must be talking about other white women because I'm a really good person. You know, like, and then it was really doing that challenge, which was done at the time. It's now a book called Me and White Supremacy, but at the time it was on Layla's Instagram feed, and you would have to go every day and respond to the prompts publicly. So you would post this on Instagram so other people could see it. Mm-hmm. And that's very humbling, right? And I quickly moved from that defensiveness because, of course, I could had enough spiritual awareness to know that that was my ego and that there was something deeper than that that I needed to investigate, to that space of, and I write about this, I actually, at the time Spiritually Fierce was published, I actually pulled it from publication as a result of doing this work, realizing there was this huge thing that I had left unsaid. And it was my blind spot around, like, if I'm talking about sacred leadership and I'm not addressing this particular wound, then I have missed something. So I wrote a new chapter for it. And I speak about that. This was the most heart-opening, the deepest, most profound spiritual experience. And I didn't expect that. Like, I knew I needed and wanted to correct the error of my perception at the deepest layers of my being, which were both, you know, from this lifetime and then familial. And then, like, you know, my nana used to use the N-word, for heaven's sake. Like, that's only like a generation ago, you know. It there was a lot of different levels of that, but my heart just got cracked wide open to that recognition that I am that. I am the perpetrator of racial violence. I am also the one who is harmed. I am mm-hmm. that. The full sense of truth of that statement, which is not just I am all the good stuff, mm-hmm. but I am all totality of experience, and therefore I can take personal responsibility for all. And it was so deeply humbling, and that's the only word I can use to speak it. And I felt like I was blind and then I could see. And it was truly, truly life-giving. And Leila Saad speaks about this process as the rehumanization of the human heart, because to be in the world of separation, to live in the nightmare that we live in, requires a dehumanization, right? To survive it, we have to dehumanize ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this is a rehumanization. So we're waking up to, and it hurts. Oh my God, it hurts to live in the world with your heart wide open, but it is the only way. And so I pulled the book from sale. As I said, I invested in a number of experts to come in and do the work with me. I rewrote the book and republished it, and did a lot of public owning of this and a lot of education for the white women in my community. And, you know, my alpha personality type, I'm like, oh, well, if there's racism, I want to solve it. You know, it's like sitting in the discomfort of, yeah, no, this isn't going to be fixed in one generation. And I cannot take, like, I can't make myself the white savior here, right? Like, I have to sit down, shut up, and listen to Black, Brown, Indigenous voices, and stop believing that my voice is the most important voice. That was a big part of it. Like, I'd held this dear, dear desire to be published, you know, by a big publishing house. I self-publish and I'm happy to do that. But at the time, I was very invested in that. And one of the things that happened at that time is Julie Parker, the woman I mentioned earlier, she had written a book that had been accepted for publication by Hay House, which, as you probably know, is one of the great world-leading spiritual publishing houses. in her own unpacking of all of this, she realized that they actually are a very racist organization and also quite misogynistic. Like, there's a lot of men, white men, at the top of them. So she turned down their publishing mm-hmm. contract, even though she knew that would change her life. And it was a process of deep surrender, a lot of grief. I've interviewed her about it actually on my podcast, because to me that was mm-hmm. the absolute embodiment of her values. She was willing to have less and be less in order to honor the need to correct this error. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really, really honored the example that she set for me. And now it's like, sure, I love writing and publishing my own books, but mm-hmm. I don't need to be elevated. You know, the correction of the error now means that voice, the voices that have been marginalized, have been lost, have been murdered, have been tortured, they are the ones that deserve to be elevated now. And if I can get over my ego desire to be, you know, seen and witnessed and whatever, and just go, you know, if I want to do it, I'll pay for it myself. But let's make space for those voices, because that is the healing of the whole consciousness, to step out of my ego's need in order to correct the error. So I know that's a big answer, and I'm not sure that I answered your question.
Yeah, you did in a lot of ways. I've often wondered, and this is a very high, maybe philosophical, spiritual question, but I often wondered, almost because everyone carries this wound and these unconscious programs, we all come into the mm. earth as mm. and where it is. If you're whatever you're experiencing, or whatever it is that you are incarnated or embodied to transform in this lifetime, whatever energies, biases, beliefs, whatever it is it because in a prior existence you were the perpetrator of that ill? Mm. So if now I'm experiencing racism, was I once a racist? You know, like, was I once the person that was oppressing another for whatever the reason? And now I'm feeling the other side of it.
Absolutely. I mean, everything that ever was and ever will be, you have been, right? And this is humility again. Like, it's not karmic reward points. It's not like you did bad in that lifetime, therefore you get to have good in this lifetime. It's like, which is a lot of people's idea of karma, and it's not the actual truth of it. It's whatever the soul needs to awaken, the perfect conditions will be provided, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. we think, because of our egoic idea of spiritual success, that lots of money, lots of power, lots of book contracts, lots of clients, that means I'm God's favorite and I'm in good favor. Actually, mm-hmm. the lifetime in which you suffer the most might actually be evidence of your spiritual mastery, and you are on an accelerated learning path, right? So when I look at your life, and I mentioned this in our last interview, I'm like, do you think because mm-hmm. of how extraordinary mm-hmm. you are, you've been able to break free of so many, you know, familial bonds? And, you know, you exist outside of mm-hmm. time and space to me in some ways, because you've been able to make choices and enact those choices in a way that others haven't, not because they're bad or wrong, but because whatever programs that are running are still too dominant for them to be able to run. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think it's multifactorial. Like, I don't think it's an immediate cause and effect kind of thing, but I do totally agree that we are here to experience the full spectrum of what humanity offers mm-hmm. for the purposes of awakening. And there's always a choice. Will I use this to awaken, or will I use this to further the nightmare of the dream? And mm-hmm. clearly at this point in your evolution, you are like, whatever mm-hmm. is thrown at me, I will use it to awaken, right?
Exactly. And, yes, I've told you this is my last life. Yes.
I love it. You've decided. Done.
Yeah, I would say to many who could understand this, I would say, oh, me and this universe, or as you call it, it's bigger than the universe, whatever you name you have for it. I said, we have gone head to head. And I said, I am done here, you know, so you bring it and I'll transform it. You know, I was like, I'm not holding anything. I'll let it go. I won't even hold on to this physical life. I'm free of it. I always say, I do not fear my death. I am ready to transcend. Yeah. And so, yeah, I get it. And just like you on this publishing journey and creating a company, you know, it's a constant battle of the ego. Yeah. And, you know, I think I've made peace with it. And I'll tell you how I've done this. I think this might be helpful. I recognize that the mind and all of its tentacles, including the egoic mind, is in service to the body. Like it too exists. It too is a part of us. And instead of demonizing it and trying to ignore it and quiet it and, you know, I don't want to say get rid of it. I listen to it. I hear it. And so when I hear the programs, when I see the patterns and cycles, when I hear that toxic inner voice, I acknowledge it. I say, thank you. It's like a reminder. Now I see that as a reminder of something that I am to transform. And I hear myself, you know, quieting that. So it's a dull hum. It's not something that is, you know, it's kind of like the backseat driver, you know, like just imagine having your child telling you which way to turn and what to go. And you're like, hey, you're in the backseat, right? I'm in the driver's seat. And it's like that. I just remind it that doesn't rule me. So I will feel it. I feel it come out. All of those biases. And for me, it's not the race. Like that would be me, I guess, being a racist of my own self, which, you know, I don't believe that I am. But it's the idea of like my triggers. I still have some obesity.
Yeah.
When I see people that aren't taking care of themselves, smoking drugs, you know, alcohol, whatever their vice, I feel it. I feel the bias. I feel the judgment. I feel the I'm better than that start to come up. I feel it. And as soon as I begin to feel it, I like nip it right there. I'm like, stop. Because I've said this and I'll say it again. The only buttons that can be pushed are the ones that are already within me. And so I say, what is it about me that triggers me? And then I begin to do the work again and again and again. And I say, but the good news is that the more that you do this introspection, this process of introspection, this the work of ascension, the easier that it is. You have more tools, and each vibrational upward shift, I believe, is incremental. It may be a small awareness or a small thing that you do or say or think that's just different now. Like you said, now I invest in XYZ that has been a bias for me. I'm intentional. That is a shift in awareness. That's a shift in consciousness. And everything is cumulative. It's additive. And so the next challenge of the soul, the next bias, the next thing that raises up in from your own soul, from your own lineage, from your own thread of the source of all, then you have more tools to recognize it, you know, come bring it into awareness. And only from that place can it be changed. Only you can change it. But you must be aware that you carry it within you in the first place.
Absolutely. That's it, isn't it? That's what the awakening journey is. It's waking up to what is. And when you're asleep to what is, you can't change it.
Exactly. So, or you feel powerless to change it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the way. And that's why awakening can be so uncomfortable, because, oh my goodness, to acknowledge what is often just, yeah, ripping off a Band-Aid, you know. It's right, okay, I have to look this straight in the eye. And I love what you're saying, because it's that idea that the language I use is fear is a friendly ally. Where there is fear, there is good information about where I've forgotten I am God. And that's my,
Well, when I speak about these incremental shifts, these conversations that we're having, the acts that we do, this they can be very small in the whole context of the world of existence. They perceptively, they can be small. Everything that we do to bring up another being in our wake, all of it matters. And so I'm going to end this with a quote that I think is very beautiful, and I shared it on prior podcasts, but I think it's very relevant here. It is a quote by David Mitchell that says, "My life amounts to no more than one drop in a limitless ocean. Yet what is any ocean but a multitude of drops?" And with that, Ricky Jane, I want to say thank you so much for joining us again on the Be Conscious podcast. And if you'd like to share how the audience can reach you and learn more about your works, I'd love for you to do that.
Yes, thank you so much. If you want to know more about the Institute, it's the Institute for Intuitive Intelligence.com, or you can go to RickyJaneAdams.com and learn more about me and my books.
Thank you so much, Ricky Jane. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you for taking this inner journey with us today. And whether you are coming or going, looking inside or out, remember to be conscious. If you loved this episode and if today's message resonated with you, please subscribe, rate, and review the Be Conscious podcast. I want to know what inspired you and what conscious topics you would like to hear more about. And if you want, you can share those thoughts and questions with me at info@susannicholas.org.
Thanks for listening to the Be Conscious podcast with author, TEDx international speaker, and conscious coach, Dr. Susan Nicholas. Be sure to connect with her to stay up to date with her latest news and works. Learn more about her conscious speaking platform at susannicholas.org/speaking. Stay tuned for the next thought-provoking episode. And whether you are coming or going, looking inside or out, remember to be conscious.